Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you are in the know. You can find the club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. My name is Bob Soldick, past chair of the Commonwealth Club's Board of Governors, and I will be your moderator for today's program. And now it's my real pleasure to introduce our special guest, A. Barry Brand, CEO of the American Association for Retired People, also known now as AARP. Our speaker, A. Barry. A roar of applause.
There you go.
That's more like it. Our speaker today, A. Barry Rand, CEO of AARP, has fought for social change his entire life. Throughout his career, he has been a strong advocate for inclusion and for making sure that everyone has a fair shot at the American dream. He's had a really remarkable career. With a BA degree from American University, an MBA from Stanford, Barry and his wife Donna live now in Stanford, Connecticut, and have two adult children. Mr. Rand joined the Xerox in 1968. He worked his way up to senior positions in the firm, finally taking over as executive vice president for worldwide operations, responsible for Xerox's $18 billion business. He oversaw a workforce of 70,000 employees in over 150 countries. He's a recognized leader in corporate social change, while at Xerox became active in bringing more minorities and women into the company and up into the management ranks. He also helped to make Xerox the most diverse company in the Fortune 500, while also helping it to earn two prestigious Malcolm Baldrige Quality Awards. After 32 years with Xerox, he left and then became chairman and CEO of Avis, growing Avis to be number one in its field. He continues to serve on several boards and advisory committees. In 2009, Mr. Rand became CEO of AARP, an organization of 40 million people aged 50 and older. AARP's mission is to enhance the quality of life for all of us as we age. He also currently serves as the chair of the board of Howard University, and now it is my great pleasure to introduce our very special guest, A. Barry Rand, CEO of AARP, formerly known as the American Association of Retired Persons. Thank you very much.
Well, the Commonwealth Club, the place where you are in the know, I hope I can share some information with you that you'll find valuable and useful. Well, good afternoon. And I want to thank Bob for inviting me here, and thank you also for the generous introduction. It's a pleasure to return to the Bay Area. I've spent many years in the Bay Area. In fact, this is one of my top three cities, the top three areas in the United States to live. So I'm back home, and I appreciate any opportunity to come back here. Now, I did my graduate work at Stanford, and it was fortunate enough to spend time in Palo Alto at the Palo Alto Research Center when I also was with Xerox. And I've already said that I've grown very fond of this area. So let me get started. Since I came to AARP just about a year ago, I've come to realize that AARP members have two things in common. And first, they are all 50-plus, but that's about the only demographic trait that the members share. Half of our members are retired, and half are still working or trying to work. Half in Medicare, half too young to be in Medicare. Our membership is approximately one-third Democrat, one-third Republican, one-third independent. So you can imagine the discussions that we have within our membership. Now, I can simply look across this room and see exactly why the organization that represents 50-plus has stopped referring to ourselves as the American Association of Retired Persons, and that's why we say AARP. So who retires now at 50? Not too many people. Maybe the kids in Silicon Valley. They may sort of hang out for 2 years, and then they'll come back and see if they can make their next fortune. But not too many of us are retiring at 50. Now, the second thing our members agree upon, though, is that their American dreams are still not fully fulfilled. There's still more to do. Now, people talk about the American dream, and they talk about it often enough that it may sound like a cliche, easy rhetoric for people who are on the stump, and they talk about the American dream. But I need to tell you, or at least help you understand, that the American dream is as relevant now as it has ever been, and that we must all work to keep it that way. The dream for older Americans varies greatly from person to person, but there are constants. This generation wanted to make it in life, and maybe more importantly, wanted to make sure that you enjoyed life. But they also wanted to pass on that success to future generations. It's the term of paying forward. That was one of the elements that this generation said they wanted to do. Now, when we were growing up, there was nothing we couldn't aspire to. And I was told by my family, who luckily had high expectations for me, and that if I worked hard and performed well enough, that I could achieve whatever I wanted. And while some of us had to work harder for it than others, it was available. Now, our horizons were endless, and our parents challenged us to aim high, relying on revitalized public school system that sent America to the head of the class on a global basis. Corporate America leveraged the innovation and worked and used the work ethic to ensure that their employees were invested in their strongest resource, those of you sitting here and elsewhere. And so they had new perks like defined benefit pensions and health care coverage. The government was there too. The GI Bill opened doors for young people. It was nothing but opportunity in front of them. The Civil Rights Act gave minorities opportunities that profoundly changed this nation for the better. Social Security offered stability and support to people who previously suffered in poverty. And Medicare provided health security to millions of Americans who had previously been shut out. Now, I can't imagine the pride that our parents felt knowing that they left this country in a better place than they found it. And right now, it may be difficult to imagine that, because when I look at the trends that we see today, when I listen to the concerns of our generation and the next generation, who worry that we may not leave America a better place than when we found it. The dream of older Americans has always included success, paying it forward. And people fear that American dream is at risk of fading. And today we face a different reality than yesterday. People of all ages and incomes have trouble navigating the economy. 70% of our members, of you, tell us that they still have kids on the payroll, and many of them are supporting both children and parents. We call ourselves the sandwich generation. And they're anxious about their health security. They struggle to continue to live in homes and communities that may no longer fit the lifestyles or meet your needs. Without each of us, individuals, business, and government, waking up to this new reality, the next generation's aspirations will be lower. They may be lower, and their dreams not realized. But let me be clear. If we cannot leave this country to our children and our grandchildren in a better shape than we found it, this will be our greatest failure. Not just leaving older Americans' dreams unfulfilled, but also paralyzing at the same time generations to come. And so, ladies and gentlemen, part of my message is that this is our wake-up call. So where do we start? Where do we start? It all begins with jobs and productivity. And if we are to leave this country better than we found it, we need everyone to contribute. And that has to include older workers. Because for our economy, our country, to move forward, we're going to need productivity of all Americans, including older Americans. no longer is a 60-something looking for a rocking chair on a porch and a glass of lemonade to sip. Now, we work either by necessity, choice, or both. And our current system has not yet adapted to that. The labor force continues to age. Whether you like it or not, the number of workers 55 and older is growing at nearly 4 times the rate of the overall labor force and already accounts for 20% of the workers today. Today's older workers are healthier, living longer than ever before. This trend is irreversible. And as the number of older workers climb, so do the instances of conflict between this new reality and the outdated ways of thinking. From 2006 to 2008, the EEOC saw a nearly 50% increase in the number of charges of age discrimination. The obsolete stereotypes many employers say that older workers aren't worth training. Myth. We know it's a myth. They avoid new technology. Myth. They are not capable of innovation. Myth. And worse still, the decision to keep an experienced worker or bring on someone new is often made based on incomplete dollars and cents analysis. The flawed math says that an older worker is paid more and is more likely to increase the company's health care costs. Therefore, hiring the inexperienced worker and letting the older worker go is often perceived incorrectly as the right cost-cutting move. Now, this is a sustainable track, unsustainable track for the workforce as it ages. Unsustainable. The avoidable loss of stability and institutional knowledge says it is not sustainable. Common sense and morality agree. And we're not just talking about people who would like to keep working and aren't being allowed to do so. You simply cannot let 20% of your skill and your innovation and experience walk out of the door and expect to stay in business. As someone who led more than 70,000 employees at Xerox, I know that we can agree, especially those of you here over 50, that your talents, your dedication, your innovation, your hard work, and that tremendous work ethic sums up. They cannot sum it up by the number of candles on the birthday cake. That's not what we are. And as a 65-year-old who made recently my own decision to re-career, I know that I have plenty of good work left, a lot to do. Now, one reason people are working longer is that their retirement savings are not adequate to sustain their longer life. That expectancy has grown over 30 years since the turn of the century. So it's critical that we look at the economic security of people. After their days in the workforce are over, we need to understand, are they situated financially to make it? Just last week, a study showed that one-third of the workers have less than $1,000 in savings, just $1,000. More than half reported that their total value of their household savings and investments is less than $25,000. Fluctuations on Wall Street impact those who have actually saved for their retirement. And with the housing market's recent collapse, the primary source of savings for most Americans took a huge financial hit. No new news. Add on to that the simple reality that a 60-year-old doesn't have much time to wait for the market to rebound, and it doesn't take an economist to see how a lack of financial security is going to affect us all. So let's be real. $25,000 isn't going to last very long. Social Security will only get you so far. So in a presentation to AARP last month by the Harvard professor Elizabeth Warren, was quick to point out that a whopping $5 trillion, and that's trillion with a T, has been lost in pension and savings accounts just since 2008. Let's hope that the stock market's recent spurt will continue. But in the meantime, 120,000 middle-class families are filing for bankruptcy each month. One in nine middle-class families cannot make their minimum credit card payments. And this is not just a problem for the old or the poor. Retirement security is a problem for all of us. And too many businesses aren't helping or don't believe that they can help. Our system of health care and financial security is anchored by our employer-based system. And in 2007, only 16% of the companies offered a defined benefit pension. Less than half of those companies offered both a defined pension and a 401k. Now, meanwhile, outside of the workforce, but undeniably linked to it, are the health care costs. Now, I realize that health care is a polarizing issue in America today. And if there's one person in this country you don't have to remind of that, it's probably the CEO of AARP. But regardless of how you feel about current efforts to reform the system, there are some truths that we can all agree on. First and foremost, skyrocketing health care costs are cancer spreading unchecked throughout our nation. From large businesses to small businesses to solo practitioners to retirees, health care costs are out of control. And the share of those costs sometimes continue to be shifted from employers to employees. And further, while Medicare is a great program for over the 65 grouping and the disabled, we have a system that is set up to discriminate against those who are not quite eligible for the program. So more than 7 million Americans between 50 and 64 were uninsured in 2007. Half of those without insurance were employed. So these are not just people who lost the coverage when they lost their jobs. And you here in California, having spent the last several weeks in the national spotlight, understand the challenges people face in the individual health insurance market. The price increases, well, what can you say about them? You can't live with them. In fact, the insurance industry's own trade group states that among people 50 to 64, one in six applicants for individual insurance is rejected at age 50. One in four at age 60. Now, we can argue all day about how to get them the coverage they need, but what is clear is that without coverage, they tend to arrive in Medicare sicker, and that's a bill that's becoming more and more difficult to pay. As many in this room know all too well, health care costs are hitting employers just as hard. We've heard the stats that Starbucks spends more on health care than it does on coffee, that GM spends more on health care than it does on steel. But it's not just the behemoths with tens of thousands of employees who are hurting. The share of small employers offering health insurance declined from 68 to 62% from just 2000 to 2008. We have no reason to believe that that trend is easing. If we stay on the current path, by 2018, the annual cost of health benefits to small businesses will be $330 billion, double the cost in 2009. And small business wages will fall. They will fall by $172 billion. As those jobs go away, our economic engine will slow. For each 1% rise in unemployment, 1.1 million people will become uninsured unless things change. They will increase Medicaid enrollment at a cost of taxpayers of $3.4 billion, which, as you know only too well here in California, puts tremendous pressure on the state budgets. Now, I'm dwelling on this point because health care costs are one of the main threats to the opportunity and prosperity of the generation to come. It puts tremendous pressure on anybody sitting in this room. This cannot be our legacy. It can't be. As we adapt our understanding of working and living in America, we must also look at the more basic aspects of our new reality, including where and how and with whom people live as we age. Our members tell us that they want to stay active and engaged in the communities they've built. They want to share their communities with the next generation. They want to create an environment where their families can live and shop and play. And here in California, you've helped define the vision of the idyllic suburbia. You did a great job. But the suburban haven that used to symbolize middle-class success has now come to represent an outdated hindrance to many. To account for the exploding populations, many suburban towns, and I'm not just talking about California, were drawn up with no thought to public transportation or even sidewalks in many cases. As mobility decreases, the cul-de-sac communities are harder to get to and to get through. People who live in the suburbs are dependent on their cars, but as people get older, they drive less or not at all. So how do they connect with society? How do we stay engaged? How do we get to the doctor, to the houses of worship, to the grocery store, or to see friends? In many cases, they don't. They become isolated. Now, this is especially problematic when people look to others for care. The options available to them fall short, and almost universally people say that they want to age in their own homes and avoid becoming a burden on their children. The same children that many of you support today. But this is a generation that wants independence. And unfortunately, too few for the costs of that long-term care, too few of those costs will be provided for. Now, as a result, the biggest funder of long-term care in America is Medicaid, which is designed right now to drive people into the one place they may not want to be, institutional care settings. The American dream used to mean that every morning started a brand new day. And lately it seems like we're living the same day over and over. So friends, this is our wake-up call. We need to stop living in the past. AARP is not interested in applying yesterday's solutions to today's challenges and threatening tomorrow's opportunities. Yes, these challenges are great. Yes, our country is facing tough times. The fact is, I have no doubt that our country is capable, that our people are willing, and that this generation, my generation, your generation, can be a force that propels us toward better solutions. And these solutions are not just for older Americans. They are for all Americans. They are not solutions focused on the short-sighted terms of debt or aging, but on the more fundamental value of restoring the American dream for everyone. And most importantly, they are not solutions just for the government or just for private industry or just for individuals to implement alone. They are issues that we have to work together on. And that includes AARP. And for starters, AARP is working with the business community to help employers realize the opportunities and benefits of an older workforce. Companies need the experience, the skill, the loyalty, the innovation of older workers, of us. Younger workers benefit from having the experienced mentors around. And the economy benefits from having people in the workforce longer, adding value, increasing revenue. For the last several years, AARP awards the top companies in the country for their employment of workers 50 plus. We recognize these companies are looking for value. We reward them because of their workplace culture, their benefits that they offer, and other policies. We highlight them for millions of our members and for other employers to emulate. We offer job counseling to help older workers, and we try to connect them with employers. And this includes online counseling as well as job fairs across the country. And because too many employers still fail to see the light, we work with Congress on anti-discrimination legislation to enforce our country's laws as well as a fundamental American belief in fairness. AARP is also helping generations of workers to build nest eggs as they prepare to retire. With the demise of the traditional pension, the retirement savings of too many Americans are in shambles today. There are tools available to help, and we're working to create more. We're working with companies to automatically enroll employees into a 401k or other employer-provided savings plans. We have also worked with Congress to create automatic IRAs, a helpful portable tool to help tens of millions of American workers whose employers do not offer workplace savings plans. AARP has teamed up with everyone from the FDIC to Operation Hope to push for financial literacy across all the generations and all the socioeconomic classes. We want plain language to be used whenever possible in financial documents. And most visibly, AARP has been involved in the Social Security debate. Now, let me take a moment and set the record straight on our position. We agree that Social Security has long-term solvency issues. Unfortunately, that's the case. We further know that changes made today are unlikely to impact those currently in the program. Changes made today unlikely to impact those who are currently in the program. But changes are necessary to help future generations, your children, your grandchildren. And our members, many of them understand this. Social Security is a math problem, one that can be solved with a reasonable combination of revenue and benefit adjustments. And to be clear, a conversation about fixing it should not be confused with the political gamesmanship about appealing to the political masses. For years, AARP has urged lawmakers to break through the political gridlock and have a thoughtful, productive discussion on fixing Social Security's long-term solvency. And this can be done to protect future generations without harming current beneficiaries. Without Social Security, almost half of today's seniors would be living in poverty. And so our members understand better than anyone how important Social Security is, and this is why they overwhelmingly want to be available for their kids and for their grandkids. Now, we also understand that the longer we wait to fix it, the harder those decisions become. And again, these solutions are to help all generations, not just our own. The auto IRA will provide more security to younger workers than to those nearing retirement. That's a fact of age and time in the workplace. Extending Social Security solvency beyond 2039 will protect younger Americans more than it will help anyone over 60 today. But we're talking about our children and our grandchildren. Financial literacy is as much about making sure people starting to invest know what they're buying as it is about making sure established investors have the information they need. Now, while corporate America can provide the tools, AARP can provide education. The government can help things along at the end of the day. The individual still has to decide they want to save for their future. The responsibility is shared by us all, including the individual. Now, it's the same thing with health care, an issue that has clearly divided so many of us. And what we know is that a health care fix must reduce costs and improve care. It doesn't matter if you're 29 or 69. It's simply more beneficial to our society if we're healthier than if we are sick. You cost less, we cost less, we can contribute more. Now, I didn't have to have my MBA to figure that one out. AARP is working with the private sector and lawmakers to build better communities that serve an aging America and generations to come. We need to make sure that as the stimulus funds are spent on shovel-ready programs, that our planners are looking to the future. That mobility is being considered from mass transit to sidewalks so that no one is stranded in the suburbs today or tomorrow. that homes are built so people can age in them with wider doorways and easy-to-use kitchens and safer bathrooms. Those of you who are familiar with ARP know that we are very strong on these livable communities. ARP is also finding ways to help people stay connected in the communities and keep them vibrant. Remember, it's not them I'm talking about. It is us. It is the future. And it's a future that we want to lay for our children and our grandchildren. I'm going to talk about our volunteers for a moment. We have more than 9 million volunteers, donors, and activists looking for ways to give back to their communities. In 2009, 7% of our people over 45 volunteered on their own or through an organization. We're working to increase that number, but it shows that older Americans have something worthwhile to share. They want to share, and they have the desire to share it with our communities. An opportunity is lost every day that a jazz musician can get to the nearest elementary school to teach children what he knows. Another passes when an experienced writer lacks the resources to tutor the college students in his or her town. People want to stay engaged, and we must work to ensure that entire lifetimes of information and knowledge are not wasted. Further, ARP is urging federal and state lawmakers to rebalance how they spend Medicaid, how we spend the Medicaid dollars on long-term care. As Americans age, their homes are not in more, they don't want their homes in the more costly institutional care settings that state budgets provide. Money can be saved or spent on other priorities. And on average, Medicaid can pay for 3 adults in home and community-based care strategies for every 1 person in a nursing home. And so we are for and have been advocating for state and home community care, home and community care. The big issue of health and economic security cannot be boiled down to the old versus the young. What impacts one group affects the other, and younger people care about the same things older people care about: the economy, health care, and jobs. And they are not problems unique to the particular age group, and they must be solved in concert. And that's my responsibility, that's your responsibility, that's our responsibility. And I see people who are not ready to be put to pasture, not ready to throw up their hands and say, I'm done, because they know more needs doing. And this is our wake-up call. There are future generations counting on us. Older Americans are not looking for charity. And I'm not here today to list programs that we need to fund people over 50 so they can live off the government. That's an erroneous myth. We have always earned our way. These problems have solutions that benefit everyone. Our members want to remain independent, and older Americans want nothing more than to help fix these problems. And why? Because they know that they have work to do. They know there is a generation or two behind them that is counting on us to deliver the world safely to them in better condition than we found it, counting on us to keep the American dream alive. So this is our wake-up call. It is ARP's responsibility to help make that happen. It is private enterprise's responsibility to help make that happen. It's your responsibility to help make that happen. Again, this is our wake-up call. I'm not done with my work, and neither are you. So I want to thank you very much. I hope in some part this has been interesting to you, and I'm happy to take any questions. Thank you.
Our thanks to A. Barry Rand, CEO of AARP, for his remarks this afternoon. It's now time for tonight's audience question period. And, Mr. Rand, we have a lot of questions.
I'm looking at them. This is the biggest fear, the questions you can't answer.
I doubt if it'll be a problem for you. Yeah. Several questioners, and I'll consolidate this, have asked about the current legislation working its way through Congress. Assuming it passed, will that be judged by AARP to be a good thing or not such a good thing?
I just got what the CBO score was, so let me take it out, and I'm going to answer the question. The CBO score that came out today said that bill that's moving through, of which our people are looking at the details as we speak, trimmed the deficit by $130 billion during the first 10 years, and then trims $1.2 trillion for the second 10 years. And so those who may not want reform will tell you how much it will cost, but they won't tell you the net effect that it has on the deficit. So it does decrease the deficit in the first 10 years and $1.1 trillion over the second 10 years. So I'd say that's a good thing. And the reason why that's a good thing is that we need to put a stop to the increase, the rate of increase, so that there is not the same discussion on the amount of costs that we have to cut. So this is a good thing. It's positive. Is it as much as we all want? The answer is no. Is it a positive thing? The answer is yes. But let me tell you what we're hoping this bill does for Americans. You've seen here the issues associated with insurance reform. Today, without insurance reform, older people can be charged 10 times more than a younger person. In some states, there's no cap. I believe in Louisiana, it's 14. 14 times. Now, do we think that's fair? Do we think that situation needs to change, and is that change good for America? I would say yes, that's good for America. The end of pre-existing conditions. Do we think that's good? AARP thinks it's good. We've been advocating for that. So the answer is, we define health care reform not how other people may define it. It's going to kill grandmama, which we all know now is a overstatement. I'll be polite. We define it in terms of what we believe is good for America and what we've been advocating for. How many people want to have their prescription drug costs lowered? We all do. And so we're hoping that what's in the bill is the closing of the donut hole. The closing of the donut hole. How many people are concerned that their children who are trying to get through school, may not have a job, can't find health insurance or can't afford health insurance? Well, we're hoping that this bill says that they can be on yours. Now, we're paying for them a lot anyway, and so it's a break to be able to have them on yours. And so we believe that these are steps forward. And so the answer is yes. There are many benefits that we get from the passing of the health care bill. I'd be the first to say we were advocating for more. We don't know how much we will get, but we believe that they're very good things that change the shape of what you can expect for your own health care security.
Okay. Just on a follow-up question, a member asks, what is the AARP outlook on the public health care option, which was pushed forward originally and now has been dropped?
Well, we were mute on the health care option. And the reason why we were mute is because there was nothing to assess. Who knew what that meant? And so we had several principles. Does it lower the cost? Is it a combination of public and private? Is it going to be transparent? Does it not kill competition, all competition? So we had a series of things. If, in fact, moved forward, and so we were prepared, but we didn't. We were not opining on it because there was nothing to opine. I doubt if it's going to be in any bill. We have forms of it on a much smaller scale with the exchanges, which will help with the costs. Full stop.
A lot of your efforts seem to be on education, and a questioner says, why do so many seniors not seem to understand that Medicare and Social Security are both government programs? How do we get through that gap?
Well, we believe that we have the opportunity to continue to educate, and that's one of the reasons why we put focus on it. As I said before, we are a diverse organization, and the good thing is that people get their information from a number of different sources. And the proliferation of a number of different sources can influence you. So I don't know why this occurs. And I will tell you this. I have salon dinners that I sponsor in Washington with the movers and the shakers, the thought leadership. And we are now switching to financial security. And so we invited a number of these people that you would all recognize their names. And so they were talking about issues associated with financial security. And they were talking about the trust in government and the mixed messages and how does this happen, and the mixed messages cause polarization. Well, we've seen that. But they said, well, there's some things that we just all recognize as a problem. And I said, well, give me an example. And they said, well, the $500 billion associated with Medicare cuts. I mean, who's going to believe that it doesn't affect benefits? And so they just dismissed it. It doesn't, you know, who's going to believe that? And so that's a trust issue. So at the end of the meeting, I said, well, we should have probably talked about 3%. How do you think 3% reduction in Medicare, how do you think the discussion would be around that? And I said, well, you know, 3% is still something that people are going to recognize, but it's more reasonable. 3% is reasonable. I mean, everybody can take 3%. I won't say everybody. Most people, many people can take 3% off what they're spending now if they think they're going to get something in return, like lower prescription drug costs, like no pre-existing conditions, like insurance policies that will cost much less because we're doing away with being able to charge 10 times more in insurance policies. And so they say, well, 3% is okay. And I said, what if I told you that the 500 number, now it's, I think, 400 in this particular thing, is only 3%? I said, well, what do you mean it's only 3%? I said, it's 3% of the Medicare budget. I said, just 3%? And I said, yes. And so they looked at each other and said, well, how did this other number come up? How did the people think that, why was this such a big deal then? I said, well, we can't control all the messages. And because we can't control all the messages, we can't stop the education process. We have to get to more people and tell the story. And so one of the reasons why I'm here is to tell the story. And answer the questions directly that you have.
Several questioners have asked questions along the lines of, how does the AARP arrive at a political position? Are you under a lot of pressure, or is your board under a lot of pressure from people on the left and on the right to support their positions? How do you decide what you are for and what you're not for?
Well, two things. We're always under pressure. We're under pressure to support. We're under pressure to not support. We're always under pressure. But we've been under pressure for 50 years. And the reason why we can sustain the pressure that we're under is that we don't make political decisions. That's not what we're about. We have huge depth in policy. We have a mission. And our mission includes, it's fairly narrow. It is affordable, accessible health care for all Americans. It is financial security. We put those two things together, and it says you can't have the American dream without those two things. This is fundamental. This is fundamental. So that's our mission. So when we look at health care, we are looking at what is it our people need, our members need? What is it that Americans need? We know that it's wrong to have so many people who don't have access to health care and they can die. We know that's wrong. And so we say it should be open and affordable and accessible to all Americans. Then we say, how do we make sure the costs go down? And so we advocate for people who need to have lower costs associated with their drugs, who today don't take them when they get into the donut hole. They don't take them. They can't afford it. And they get sicker. So we define our policies and our position based on what we believe facilitates affordable, accessible health care for all.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our speaker today is A. Barry Rand, CEO of AARP, who is discussing health, finance, and other concerns of older Americans. Mr. Rand, we've got several people who are wondering about let me read a couple of these questions. When will AARP start promoting its ample services to the Hispanic community and the Spanish-speaking media? Another question, what is AARP doing to improve internet communication with their members and so forth? How do you support all these people that you're trying to serve?
Let me start with how do we reach them. We have the largest magazine circulation in the United States. We have the Bulletin. You see us in some of the web-based communications. But the fact of the matter is, when we look at our strategy, we say, what is a sustainable advantage that we have that we can control? And in fact, most of the messaging years ago we could control because more people went to the traditional way of informing themselves, bulletin, magazines, newspapers, those kinds of things. But it's changed, obviously. So now the internet has taken up. Social networking is pervasive. You get information through your cell phone and all kinds of other devices. And so the question is, are we going to be where you want us to be so that you have your choice of where you get your information? And it's our obligation to be there. So from a strategic standpoint, that's what you will see. You will see us over time being where you want us to be. Now, let's assume we do that and we do it well. The other issue is our intent has always been more Americans. As we take a look at our relevance, we know that our awareness and our relevance is not as high as we would like to be in many of the communities of color, where you're talking about Asian communities or Latino communities or black communities. We have millions of Americans who want to understand what we're doing. We have an opportunity to be able to demonstrate in communities of color where we have disparate health differences. We can help. And so we will be offering and getting more information to all Americans, all the communities that we believe can take advantage of what assets we have at AARP.
You have many questions about the AARP's. No, it just didn't take them. Write it down. I'm sorry. What I started to say was that we have several members asking about the actual treatment that they're experiencing. Let me read one or two of these questions. A lot of seniors these days take more than a dozen different medications. How do we get away from this? Isn't there a better way to treat the ailments of the aging? Another question, what is AARP doing to increase wellness other than disseminate information?
Well, we're doing a number of things. Let me see if I should say this. Let me tell you that we are testing now in about four cities across the country a concept of more integrated health care. That we all know that we have silos today. The information is siloed. Issues like, are you taking your medication? Who helps in certain situations? So we are looking at how do we have better integrated health care. And so I'm hoping that within the next year we can talk more about it, have some positive results, and then show what we do for you actively that in this case is beyond information. What I should do is make a commitment to be able to list these things that we do that may not be widely known, and we'll make sure that we publicize them in our bulletin, in our magazine, so you can at least answer the question and make your own judgment. This is good, not enough, but we are doing some other things. Okay.
Several people have sort of told their own story. Let me read one to you. At age 54 and unemployed, I'm having difficulty qualifying for affordable health care. My wife, 20 years my junior, is instantly accepted by a major carrier, but I am engaged as the subject of numerous medical testing criteria and scrutiny at my own expense. What options do you see for me if I am, quote, rejected? It seems 30-year-olds get in, no problem, but they don't want seniors.
Well, I am hoping that in this new health care bill is a solution to that. If you've been rejected because of pre-existing conditions, as an example, you'll have more alternatives than you have now. This is one of the issues that we have been pushing for, and many Americans pushing for. It is, what are these barriers that keep Americans from having insurance? Why do we get denied? What can we do to change it? And so I'm hoping that what you will see is a specific answer to that once the details come out. And I think we can both celebrate if that's the case.
A questioner says, at least one major drugstore chain, I won't mention it, has reportedly stopped accepting new Medicare patients and some at some locations. How do you react to this? Is this something AARP would get involved with?
Well, the answer is I'm unaware of that fact. I'll have to go back and check it. There have been instances where what was publicized, like the Mayo Clinic. How many of you saw that the Mayo Clinic in their Arizona location had stopped taking Medicare? Any of you remember that? Okay. Well, it just so happened that 2 weeks later, the CEO of the Mayo Clinic came to visit me. We had a good conversation. They want to join with us. And I said, well, I like that. Sounds good. We want you to join with us. But tell me, why did you stop taking Medicare in Arizona? He said, we didn't. We had five physicians that decided they were going to go off on their own and do it. And that's what they did. Five, not the entire facility. And he's not a proponent of that. As you know, some doctors have this degree of independence. But the reason why I'm telling you that story is to just let you know that everything you hear immediately may not seem like it does. I will go and investigate that.
What clout does AARP have with the insurance companies? What if the new health care bill passes?
Well, if it passes, then all of us have clout. That's what we're trying to do, as a matter of fact. Someone called me up and read me the Riot Act, and they said, you're an insurance company, and you do this, you do that. And I said, well, why do you call us an insurance company? Well, you're an insurance company. I said, well, who told you we're an insurance company? I said, let me tell you how we got started. We got started over 50 years ago when our founder, who was a retired teacher, was looking for some of her old friends, went looking for her, knocked on the door that was the address, and they said, no, she's in the back. People heard the story? She's in the back. They went to the backyard. She was living, this is over 50 years ago, this is 58 years ago. She was living in a chicken coop, a retired teacher living in a chicken coop. Because at that time, seniors could not get insurance, could not have access to insurance, had meager retirement. And it was from that moment she swore that this should not happen in America and went about building what we now call AARP with a mission that I discussed about health security and financial security. That's how we got started. It took her years to get insurance companies to provide insurance for seniors until she found out that there was strength in what we call today the pool. It was strength in numbers. And it was through the strength in numbers that she worked with insurance companies to design policies that were beneficial for seniors. And that's how we started. We do not sell insurance. We help design some of the policies that are associated in recognition of what can be. And when I say design, we work and say, here's what the members are saying that they need. And we endorse. But we do not sell insurance. We're not an insurance company. So when you say, what clout do we have? We're like you. We want insurance reform. We wanted insurance reform 50 years ago. We still want it. We still hammer away at it. And so we use the collective voice of our membership. We use our advocacy strength. We use our education to break down these barriers. So the insurance companies don't like it when we say do away with pre-existing conditions. We don't say lower. They don't like us when we say lower the cost. We're right with you. Whatever you think is needed, you should not be surprised that we're doing the exact same thing. We want health care, affordable health care, accessible health care for all. That's our mission. That's what we do.
This question really addresses your former life as a CEO of a large company. Is there any significant movement in corporate America to see that social responsibility is in reality the better way to increase bottom line profitability?
Well, I would say now more than 20 years ago, there's increased sensitivity to the demographics changes and a more mature recognition of the value of each individual. I don't believe that I'm being overly optimistic when I say I believe that there are improvements. The real issue, though, is not that. The real issue is that we need this economy going. We need more opportunities for more people, and that's what we are focused on. And so when the opportunities open up and the economy is growing, then we can all sit back and make a judgment as to whether or not everybody is receiving opportunities from that.
Okay. Here's a question which just arrived. How else does AARP educate people besides their magazines and bulletins and internet? And isn't the healthcare reform going to cost Americans a lot in taxes and less dollars for Medicare, for medicine and so forth?
We're going to see the bill, and you can answer that question. But when I tell you that it decreases the deficit, this is sort of a virtuous circle. If it hadn't decreased the deficit, you would bet that there would be more conversation about cutting Medicare or Social Security or other things that are called entitlements. And so that's the reason why it was important to reduce the deficit. We have to do that. And so that's the reason why if the bill doesn't pass, the other point that it will cause is that we will end up having other cuts, whether it's in the expense side or other sides. So we've passed the first test. The second test is what we will see in the detail. And you have to measure that against the benefits that it has. So I don't know the answer, the specific answer, because we haven't seen all the detail. I will tell you that everything that I have seen and everything that you have said, you've heard, I won't say as an exaggeration, but I will simply say that you can either talk about the gross costs or the net costs. And I would say that because you didn't know whether or not a person was talking about the gross or the net, you would walk away with completely different interpretations of what the health care bill has and doesn't have. But we will find out shortly, okay. One way or another.
A questioner says missed diagnoses are a major issue, especially, for example, sleep apnea, which affects 30% of people 55 and older and causes increased rates of strokes, heart attacks, and so forth. Better insurance coverage will not stop this. And I guess the question really is, does AARP launch into any efforts to educate physicians on how to do their job better?
I can say yes and no. I can say yes that we have partnerships with the Cancer Society. We have other partnerships as it relates to breast cancer and therefore help with the education. When you get down to that specific, I can't answer it. I would assume that we don't there. But when I say yes or no, we partner because we are trying to educate on how we can give information that can help improve your health regime, where to go when you have health issues. So we do that. But it's more on a more global level, cancer, heart, as opposed to maybe the specific diagnosis.
Questioner asks, how do you rate the Obama administration in terms of fighting for the rights of older Americans?
Two ways. One is we haven't had anyone that has raised the flag since the Clinton administration on health care reform. And you know what happened to that. So what has it been, 50 years since? So the question is one I think you can answer. We're going to find out whether health reform is successful or not. But one of the ways to answer the question is, do you believe that health reform is needed and that you need someone who would drive it? And I think individually each of you can answer that question. So I think that, at least from our perspective, is one of the major items. We're going to have to figure out how to get jobs in this country and stimulate the economy, and that's for all of us. So you answer that question, is that being done effectively? Can we do more? But do you believe he's on it? Is the question. And the same thing when we start talking about financial security. I wanted to separate the agenda from the results, because we'll have some time to look at the results. And I think all of you can make your own. We are bipartisan and nonpartisan. And we believe that's the way to help in the political process.
Unfortunately, we've reached the point in our program where there is time for only one last question, and it's a simple one. Does Obama get age? Does he understand age, older people's problems, I guess, is the question. Any evidence of that?
Does he understand age? Well, I do a self-assessment when you ask the question, because a part of our role is education, And it's education of the members, it's education of society, it's education of the Republicans, it's education of the Democrats, and quite frankly, whoever's in the White House, it's our role to help educate and make sure that everyone understands what it means to live longer and want to live a more vibrant life. And how do you live a more vibrant life? And how do you continue to have more alternatives? And so that's what we are about, and I hope and know that you're about the same thing. And so I ask it from a introspective point of view, have we done a job in making sure that this administration, along with the other administrations, understand the issues of aging and do the right thing? I think that's the last question. I want to thank you very much. I certainly appreciate the opportunity. I hope it's been helpful. Thank you.
Our thanks to A. Barry Rand, CEO of AARP. We also thank our audiences here and on the radio, television, and on the Internet. I'm Bob Saldick, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned. Super job.